From the Moan Broadcast Center, it's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. This week, we'll hear what our critics think of the controversial movie Joker. It stars Joaquin Phoenix as Batman's nemesis. Todd Phillips directed the film. And I'm going to give away something here, a little bit of a spoiler. Our two critics strongly disagree on Joker. We'll hear why. Also, Dolomite Is My Name stars Eddie Murphy. Those and more films coming up. It's Air Talk and Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. We come your way with our movie reviews every Friday at 11 and Saturday at noon. I'm joined this week by our film critics, Christy Lemire of RogerEbert.com and co-host of the podcast Breakfast All Day, Wade Major of Synagogues.com, our film critic, and we're going to start with one of the most controversial films of the year. It's Joker, and Joaquin Phoenix stars in the film, directed by Todd Phillips, who co-wrote the screenplay with Scott Silver. Wade, you want to start us on Joker?
Yeah, that's Todd Phillips, who did the Hangover movies and Old School, and who is commonly associated with those wacky comedies. He's Bradley Cooper's partner, so Bradley Cooper gets a producing credit on this as well. And this is a complete diversion from what he has ever done before. And of course, as everyone probably now knows, this won the Venice Film Festival. And I think it is a rather extraordinary movie. It is a reinvention of the Joker as a villain. Yet another reinvention. We've reinvented this character numerous times. And the thing that has always compelled me about the Joker is that he is the monster in your closet. He's everyone's monster in the closet. And you can reinvent that monster for as many different people and as many different closets as there exist. And this is a very interesting take. It borrows a little bit from the Killing Joke line in the comics. He's a frustrated wannabe. You know, he's a dirty clown who does, you know, kiddie shows, and he wants to be a real stand-up. So there's a frustrated artist aspect to him. There's a really interesting reinvention of the backstory, but ultimately it is a study of instability in the mind and the outer instability of the world, and what happens when those two things lay over each other in an extremely volatile way. It's kind of an angry, restless movie that has a lot on its mind and isn't interested in finding any answers. It just wants to sort of poke at the audience and force you to be as restless as everyone in the movie. I find it very provocative, very thoughtful, and it's been sticking with me for a good long time.
So I was just going to ask, does that restlessness translate into you're thinking about it?
It does. It sticks with me. It really sticks with me. And I know it sticks with Christy, too. Maybe not in the same way.
Christy, your take on Joker?
So, yeah, Wade, you're absolutely right. It is extraordinary. And not in a good way. It is all empty bombast. It is so self-serious. It is just empty, vapid style. And it is so repetitive. It hits the same notes over and over again. Todd Phillips shoots Joaquin Phoenix in extreme close-up over and over again, chain-smoking, cackling at nothing. And yeah, a few times this helps make sense to establish his mindset. But over and over again, and the score is so overwhelming, and the script does so much hand-holding. There are a couple of twists that occur. And the twist itself is kind of eye-opening and kind of cool, but then it has to walk you back and explain to you, oh, that time you think this was happening? It wasn't. It was something else. And then again, it was something else. And like there are things that might have been interesting ideas that it feels the need to connect the dots for us on. Joaquin Phoenix cannot help but be good. He cannot help but provide like a disarming and physical performance and a disturbing performance. He lost a bunch of weight. And so you see him like shirtless and kind of he's contorting his body in really unnatural ways to make like his shoulder blades jut out or his hips jut out. And it's a very physical performance. And clearly he's giving it his all in a way that only Joaquin Phoenix can. But I kind of found its morality a little despicable.
Like it is.
It's trying to simultaneously.
By design.
Right. But I think it's got a couple of contradictory impulses going on here at once. It is trying to simultaneously vilify mental illness in a way that's totally icky, while also celebrating the Joker as a rock star for sticking it to the 1%. It's trying to have it both ways at the same time.
See, I don't think it's trying to have it both ways. I think it's aware that we like to try to have it both ways. And I think it's poking at us and saying, this is what you're trying to do. How do you feel about that? Now that I'm pointing out the contradiction that people wrestle with in society every day, how do you feel about it now that you're aware of it? What I like about the film most is the way that it plugs into a lot of pop culture strains. Some of them are obvious. Some of them are not so obvious. Chaplin, very obvious. They watch Modern Times in the movie. You see him really enjoying Chaplin on screen. And they play Smile at a certain point. And you're, the, you know, Chaplin, the ultimate sad clown that we love, but who is on the margins of society, as he is. But Chaplin was on the margins and successful. He is not successful. The obvious tie-in, our colleague Alonzo Duralde of The Wrap has the perfect line about it where he calls him the Travis Bickle of Rupert Pupkins. And it's very aware of those two Scorsese characters. It's very aware of the fact that this ties into both The King of Comedy and Taxi Driver. That's why Robert De Niro is here. Except now Robert De Niro is playing that late night character that Jerry Lewis played in The King of Comedy, the facsimile of Johnny Carson with the colored curtains and the whole thing. So it means to definitely point that out. The cackle, the repetitive cackle, amazing. That is a loose reference to the character that inspired the Joker, to Conrad Veidt in The Man Who Laughs, the 1928 silent based on the Victor Hugo story, in which a man is disfigured with a permanent smile as a punishment for the crimes of his father. Here, the laugh is a permanent disfigurement that is a result of a crime that was perpetrated against his parentage. So all of this stuff, these are all these interesting cultural subcurrents that tie into movies and literature, and that sort of force us to face something that we've never faced before.
We're going to pick this up later in the hour and spend some time talking about the moral issues or conflict or contradiction, Christy, that you're raising. Because I think this is really important and interesting to get into. So hold your thoughts on it. But this is great. We hear very, very different views about Joker, starring Joaquin Phoenix with Robert De Niro and Zazie Beetz. Todd Phillips directed, co-wrote it with Scott Silver. It's rated R in wide release. Also this week, the dramatic comedy Dolomite Is My Name. It's the story of Rudy Ray Moore, who was a stand-up comedian, a rap pioneer, became a blaxploitation phenomenon as he wrote, directed, and starred in a film as his alter ego, Dolomite. Here, Craig Brewer directs the movie Dolomite Is My Name. Dolomite displays his acting prowess on set.
Take one, marker.
Action.
Hold it, Dolomite.
What do you want?
FBI.
What do you want, man? Where's your warrant at?
This badge is my warrant. Open up the trunk. You're going to jail for a long time.
You're gonna have to take me!
Sounds like Dolomite. Dolomite Is My Name. Eddie Murphy stars. Craig Brewer directing, and it's written by the terrific team, Scott Alexander and Larry Karaszewski. Christy, what do you think of Dolomite's My Name?
I'm kind of amazed that you guys could find a clip that was clean, because this movie has something like 375 F-bombs or something like that. Every one of them necessary and earned. This movie is a total blast. This one, Wade and I are going to agree on. It is so much fun, and it is so meta on so many levels in the performance that Eddie Murphy is giving. I mean, he's doing Rudy Ray Moore doing Dolomite, but there's so much of Eddie Murphy's own history and his own swagger and his own screen presence and his own comeback at work here that it's a lot of fun to watch on that level. This is just impeccable from a production design and costume design perspective. Ruth E. Carter, Oscar winner for Black Panther, did the costumes. It's really rich and having a great time reveling in that 70s kind of polyester over the top look, but it's just sheer entertainment, and it's so much fun. And not unlike Joker, this is kind of a superhero origin story. You know, this is a comic book origin story. Both characters have similar drives for love and attention, and they want to be taken seriously, and they, both are stand-up comics.
Both of them live with mothers or mother figures. Both of them have troubled fathers in their background. Yeah. I mean, I counted 9 different points of commonality between these movies.
Who would think these two films are so akin?
Yeah. Really.
It's a great double feature.
they're flip sides to the American dream, and it is a double-edged sword, the American dream. It is either going to reward you and blossom, or it's going to tear you down in the process. That's the Faustian bargain. that you make here. And I think between the two films, that is in full recognition. I love this movie. This is a top 10 movie for me. But I'm an old Rudy Ray Moore fan. You know,
if only he were still with us to go out on the tour to promote the film. Can you imagine?
It was about 25 years ago. They had a Blaxploitation Festival at the New Art, and I was there for the double feature of Dolomite and the sequel, The Human Tornado, a packed theater at the New Art. And Rudy Ray Moore was there, and he did 20 minutes of material before the movies. And I look back on that. I don't think I realized at the time what a gift that was.
Yeah, what a memory night.
It was an extraordinary night. And Rudy Ray Moore has to understand, this is a guy who slaved away for decades trying to make it, trying to be something, trying to be somebody this is like a Blaxploitation Capra film. He's trying to find his place in the world. And the world keeps beating him up. And he doesn't give up. Ultimately, this is a movie about a man with an indefatigable faith in himself. Even when no one else believes in him, he believes in himself and he makes it happen. And that's what Rudy Ray Moore did. Rudy Ray Moore was the first independent filmmaker of a mainstream film to own his own negative. Not even just the first black filmmaker, the first independent filmmaker, period, to own his own negative, because he willed this movie into existence against all odds. Is Dolomite a good movie? The original Dolomite? No.
No one thinks it is. It has periods of entertainment value.
But it has his passion in it. Yeah. And he is such an infectious character.
His ego.
And his ego. And, you know, he fills you with inspiration on a level that you know, and Divine is amazing in this. We have to say Divine Joy Randolph, who plays Lady Reed, who in the original Dolomite is Queen Bee. It's an amazing relationship between these two characters who come from the same background, and it's beautiful.
She's great too in On Becoming a God in Central Florida, the Kirsten Dunst Showtime show. She's really funny in that. Yeah, I love the paradox at work here, because inherently Dolomite's material is so raunchy and so wrong and so profane, but there's such a sweetness to this film and to the way that we see Rudy Ray Moore working with his crew and with his actors to get this done. It's like an old-fashioned let's put on a show kind of story, but the show was about a pimp.
Well, and I was thinking, are there parallels with Ed Wood in a sense?
Totally, yeah. And you have appreciation for like the hands-on, low-budget, like moxie of filmmaking. Yeah.
And with the Disaster Artist is a little bit of that as well. And this is, of course, what Karashevsky and Scott Alexander do, Man in the Moon and People versus Larry Flint. They are compelled by these characters who are at the fringes, who are marginal, maybe a little unstable, but who find their place in the world anyway. And are able to really just dig in and do something in ways that no one would have expected.
And Alexander and Kara Zuski are so creative at finding ways of being true to the story, to give you the
very
sense
true
of them, but updating it in a way that really works.
It's a perfect line between pathos and comedy. You're laughing, but you're not laughing at them. They're not making a mockery of these people. It is a wonderful, wonderful film.
All right. Dolomite Is My Name, starring Eddie Murphy, also in the cast, Keegan-Michael Key, Mike Epps, and Titus Burgess. The film directed by Craig Brewer. It's rated R. You can see it at Lemley's Monica Film Center. And is it going to be streaming after that?
I think end of the month.
All right. Lucy in the Sky is a film that stars Natalie Portman and John Hamm. It's directed by Noah Hawley, about an astronaut named Lucy who loses touch with reality after a transcendent mission to space.
You know how it is. You go up there, you see the whole universe, and everything here looks so small. We're so small. And then you splash down, and what, you go to Applebee's, you know, Monday Night Football.
The film is Lucy in the Sky. Wade?
What an unfortunate mess this is. This is probably what happens when you have an incident, a famous newspaper incident that is narratively threadbare, and then you wind up with filmmakers who think that there's more poetry to the story than is really there. This is the story of the female astronaut from a few years ago who was involved in a romantic relationship with a fellow astronaut that broke up her marriage, and next thing you know, she's trucking across country to, you know, with a gun in the glove compartment to seek revenge on having been jilted because he wound up having an affair with another female female astronaut. Love triangle, love quadrangle, whatever we want to call it. That was a newspaper story. It was interesting. People thought, wow, astronauts can go crazy too. And they left it at that. And this now tries to take that incident and lead into it with a whole lot of stuff about how she went to space and it changed her vision of the world. And the aspect ratio of the movie is constantly shifting in this really irritating way. And it really doesn't have much else to say. It's unfortunately just it doesn't hang together.
Lucy in the Sky, starring Natalie Portman, in wide release. Noah Hawley directs. It's rated R. We have many more films to come. We'll tell you about them in just 1 minute on Film Week on KPCC. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Larry Mantle with critics Wade Major and Christy Lemire. Just a reminder, a little bit later on, we'll talk about the controversy over the film Joker. Warner Brothers has defended its release of the film in the wake of criticism that it glorifies the violence carried out by its central character. But first, we review the new film from Spanish director Pedro Almodóvar. It's Pain and Glory. Almodóvar wrote it as well. Antonio Banderas stars with Penelope Cruz. Christy, what do you think?
It's a really lovely film from Almodóvar and an incredibly personal one because Antonio Banderas, who is his longtime friend and collaborator and frequent star, plays kind of a version of Almodóvar. He plays an established, respected, esteemed filmmaker in middle age, maybe around 60, who is looking back on his life through the prism of the physical pain he's been in for many years and also through the memories of his childhood and his mother, played by Penelope Cruz, who is also a longtime Almodóvar muse and friend. And it's him just remembering his work and his life and his loves with sorrow, with regret, with some sweet, fond memories. Antonio Banderas is perhaps giving a career best performance here. It's really soulful and really sad, but you still see the glimmers of that incredibly charismatic movie star who has captivated us for so long. You have a lot of signature Almodóvar devices here and characters here, a lot of really fascinating women with really intriguing screen presences and strong personalities who help shape this man. There's a kind of lovely meta quality to a one-man play that's going on in the middle of the film, which is also part of his life and his ex-lover's life. So really quite lovely, sad and surreal and sweet and not perhaps as like visually bold and thematically daring as we quite often see from Almodóvar, but sort of like a nice warm hug.
All yeah, right. Yeah. What do you think, Wade?
I didn't love it, but everything Christy says is true.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's I wanted to. I like it, but for the reasons that she says, it's not as thematically or stylistically aggressive as we're accustomed to from him. I think there's something else going on here too. That in his very best films, he channels himself through female characters, and he is incredibly good with actresses, and that's where he is most at ease. And those films have just a rich emotional vibrancy. And here, I did have the sense that he felt he had to get this story out, but he doesn't quite have a handle on it the way that he would if it were something that were not personal. And because it's personal, it's more amorphous. It's a different film. It doesn't make it a lesser film. It's just different. And I think there is a trouble of expectations that if you are accustomed to Almodóvar being X, you go into this and it's Y. And I do think people have to temper those expectations a little bit. If Almodóvar did not have the legacy behind him that we're accustomed to, I would probably look at this film and go, this is one of the best films
of the year.
That's
great, yeah.
It's great. But because I have seen All About My Mother and so many other incredible movies that just rip your soul out, I did feel like there were some pulled punches here, and perhaps because it is too personal and he's not able to sort of use those dramatic and thematic vehicles that he's accustomed to. He's having to lay himself a little bit too bare.
But if he didn't have that legacy, then this film wouldn't exist.
See, that's the dilemma.
That's the catch-22
that is the
of
catch
it, isn't it?
That's it.
And if it was
it
just some random guy making a movie about, you know, his own life as a filmmaker, we wouldn't care. But we've seen the Almodovar films, and we know his life and his history and his muses. And so it is a catch-22. Yes.
It is.
Well said. Pain and Glory, the new film from Pedro Almodovar, starring Antonio Banderas and Penelope Cruz. It's rated R at the Landmark in West L.A. in the ArcLight Hollywood. The Frame's John Horn interviewed Antonio Banderas earlier this week, and you can hear that interview by visiting our Film Week page at kpcc.org. The documentary Memory, The Origins of Alien, takes a look at Ridley Scott's sci-fi film. Christy?
This is so cool. This is like a little miniature film school. And even if you haven't seen Alien in a while, even if you don't love Alien, there is so much cool nitty-gritty to like sink your teeth into here. No pun intended. I didn't mean that as a pun, but yeah, the teeth do matter here. It's about all of the aesthetic and visual touchstones and inspirations behind Alien. And sort of it's so much more than just a making of Alien. It's about going back, you know, different kinds of mythology and different kinds of art, like Francis Bacon art that inspired what the chest burster looks like. We get great behind the scenes stories of how that really iconic sequence was made and how it went wrong. And we get perspective from everybody from screenwriter Dan O'Bannon's widow to Veronica Cartwright, who is, of course, part of the crew. Tom Skerritt is in it as well, to film critics and other screenwriters, other directors. And it is so fascinating. Like, I hadn't seen Alien in a while, and I have come to appreciate it all over again. Another filmmaker, Adam Egypt Mortimer, talks about the use of sound in Alien and how it's almost like a Robert Altman film with people
talking. Yeah, that was interesting.
I had never picked up on that before. And just the use of, like, how he'll get everybody in the frame and how all of them talking over each other contributes to the sense of a working class kind of workplace film that's so different from the slick and shiny kinds of sci-fi we'd seen before. So I really loved it.
I loved it too. And there's no Sigourney Weaver and there's no Ridley Scott. So you don't have that, but because everybody has contracts to do all their own different featurettes and documentaries, and nobody wants to sort of step on other work that they've done. So given that caveat, it's really comprehensive and very impressive. And it's amazing. It's like 95 minutes long or something. It's not that long, but they compress an enormous amount of history and information into this. They cover Dan O'Bannon as a screenwriter and his life, and Dark Star with John Carpenter, and how all of that led into this, and how Walter Hill was supposed to direct this and then stepped away, and H.R. Giger was brought on and then fired, and then Ridley Scott brought him back. And then they get into the myth, the myths that inform this, the literary, the ancient Greek and medieval myths that are a part of this story. And it by the end, you feel like you just had a college course in Alien. You feel like, oh, all right, I'm ready for the final. It really is a very, very rich and impressive film.
Memory, The Origins of Alien is directed by Alexander O. Philippe, who spoke with John Horn of The Frame. You'll get a link to that interview on our Film Week page, kpcc.org. Memory, The Origins of Alien is in select theaters. Also, since we're talking of Ridley Scott, want to let you know that our Film Week next screening is going to be at the Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown Los Angeles. This is our screening series that's devoted to movies set in L.A. In this case, it's a movie not just set in L.A., but set in the year 2019. We're going to show Blade Runner, the final cut, which is the actual cut Ridley Scott oversaw. We're going to show that on the big screen at the Theater at Ace Hotel on Saturday night, November 2nd, 7 o'clock. Tickets are available at kpcc.org/in-person. Midnight Traveler documentary that takes us to the world of the Taliban. It's directed by Hassan Fazili. It's unrated. Christy?
It is a miracle that this film exists. It is a miracle that it got made and that it got out and that it got edited and that we can see it for ourselves and learn from it. So Hassan Fazili is a filmmaker from Afghanistan. And when the Taliban put out a hit on him, he fled to Tajikistan. And then when he couldn't stay there for much longer, he and his wife, who was also a filmmaker, and their two little girls, one of whom is about 7 or 8 at the film's start, and one of whom is like a toddler. She's like 2. They have to find a place to live. They are on the run. They have to entrust that, you know, various smugglers who promise to get them across various borders will actually do that and get them there safely. Whatever happened, whatever country they were hiding in, whatever forest, whatever refugee shelter they were stuck in interminably, they kept shooting. And they shot on three different mobile phones, both the filmmaker and his wife, and then both of the kids shot some of this footage as well. And it is intimate and it is harrowing. And I don't know how they had the presence of mind to keep shooting. At one point, don't the phones get confiscated?
Yes.
And they get them back, clearly.
Yeah.
But I'm just so amazed that this film exists, and it's incredibly relevant and sad and gripping and very worth seeing.
All of that and more. It is really, really timely, and it's nice to get this perspective as opposed to a news perspective, which sometimes I think builds up a little bit too many walls and too many calluses that separate us in a very antiseptic way from what's really happening. The most interesting stuff here is the family stuff.
Mm-hmm.
How does this ordeal affect them as a family? And there's even there's even a moment where he just pays an offhand compliment to a woman at a place where they're staying, and that becomes this argument with his wife. And he comes from a family of clerics. You know, he's the first one in his family who did not become a Muslim cleric. And he blames his wife for that because she's so liberalized. Yet she is much more religiously conservative on this account. She says, no more of that. No more complimenting other women and saying things you look nice today. And they get into this very interesting argument, which becomes an argument, a discussion about art and filmmaking and, well, you know, you, my wife, you've been an actress as well. You've kissed people in scenes. Yeah, but I was an actress. Very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Also, it's so relatable in that they are, you know, the whole film makes their story feel very relatable. But in terms of how we see them trying to parent their children. But that fight could be like any husband and wife in any country of any religious background, of any ethnicity, you know, having an argument about jealousy or misunderstanding.
All right. The film is Midnight Traveler, the documentary at the New Art Theater in West L.A. It's directed by Hassan Fazili, who, along with his family, are at the center of the film. It's unrated. Also, the documentary Wrinkles the Clown, about a clown hired to scare misbehaving children. Michael Beach Nichols is the director of the film. This is actually a documentary, Wade?
Believe it or not, yes. This took place in Florida. This guy is a clown he's an anonymous clown who hires himself out to parents who want to discipline their children, to scare them, to terrify them, to terrorize them. And there's footage of this. There's surveillance camera footage. And it's horrifying. It's worse than anything in Joker. It really is. This is like a real life Joker. And at a certain point in the beginning of the movie, I was wondering, is this a mockumentary? Is this a mock documentary? Are they pulling my leg? Because nobody would do that. This isn't possibly real. And it is.
Well, the Washington Post did a story about him, and he went viral because there is so much footage of him just like hanging out with some balloons, just standing on the street corner, waving to people, trying to freak them out. And he stuck these stickers of himself all over Florida with a phone number like Wrinkles, call me at whatever. And you see what Wrinkles' daily life is like, you know, but I have some questions. As to the veracity of
it. But it does take that very interesting turn in the middle of the movie.
Yes.
And we won't give it away, but there is a point of the film where you're watching it and you're thinking, okay, there is something shady about this. And then it takes this very interesting turn and you realize the truth behind the curtain, which is in a way more disturbing than what you thought it was. You're expecting to pull the curtains back and go, it's just a joke. But it's actually a little bit more serious than that.
It's also a treatise on viral fame, you know, and what the good and the bad sides of that. You see a lot of kids who make their own Wrinkles videos. Part of the fun is like the urban legend of calling the Wrinkles hotline and seeing what happens. So it's about that as well, the viral fame and how that can be a positive or negative thing.
So documentary with a question mark
afterwards? Yeah.
I don't know. Wrinkles the Clown is at Lemley's Monica Film Center, Santa Monica. Michael Beach Nichols Wrinkles. The director, Wrinkles the Clown, is unrated. Coming up, we'll hear what our critics think of the Canadian horror comedy Harpoon, as well as the drama Collisions. And we'll talk about the controversy surrounding this week's release of Joker. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Wonderful to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Next up, the Canadian horror comedy Harpoon, written and directed by Rob Grant. Christy Lemire, what'd you think?
I was very impressed by this film. I was very impressed by Rob Grant's ability to accomplish a lot with a little in a very confined space. So it is the story of three people, two guys who are best friends, and a woman who is the girlfriend of one and kind of the mother figure to the other. And the film begins with a misunderstanding, a jealous accusation that is unfounded. Nevertheless, the three go out on this yacht together, on the rich best friend's yacht, for what they think is going to be a day trip. And they have brought along with them the titular harpoon. It's actually a spear gun. And that is a running bit throughout the film. It's not really a harpoon. It's kind of like Chekhov's spear gun. And so they go out onto the boat and one bad thing happens, and then another, and then another, and then they find themselves stranded, and days go by, and it begins life as this very dark comedy. Brett Gelman does the narration, sort of a snarky, bemused narration of the three of them and their dysfunctional triangle that they are comfortably in. And it's kind of meta, the narration, as far as what their dynamic is like. And it very seamlessly becomes a straight-up horror film. It gets more and more tense as resentments bubble up and boil over, as secrets are revealed, as the truth comes out about who they all are in relationship to each other. And all three of these actors get a chance to show quite a bit of range within a confined space and a pretty short little running time here. So I liked it.
Those three actors are Monroe Chambers, Emily Tyra, and Christopher Gray. Rob Grant, the writer-director of Harpoon. It's at the Frida Cinema in Santa Ana, and it's also out on video on demand. It's rated R. Collisions, a drama that stars Isabella Alvarez. It's written and directed by Richard Levine. Wade, what'd you think of Collisions?
Very good. It's and this was programmed by our own Claudia Puig at the Mendocino Film Festival. It's the story of a woman who is taken away in an ICE raid, leaving her two children alone, and they have to go and seek out their uncle, with whom neither they or their mother have had contact in many, many years, and who wants really nothing to do with them. And he's sort of their last lifeline. What do we do to find our mom, to sort ourselves through this nightmare? And what's really good about this is that even though it's very timely and it deals with all of these issues and immigration and border and family separation, it doesn't wear it on its sleeve. It's fundamentally about a family situation, and it could be in any country, and it could be under many different circumstances. It wants you to care about the kids. And the kids are really good. I mean, they're really, really good actors, especially the girl, who's just sensational. And it does this, you know, this is kind of a subgenre in Japan, abandoned children and, you know, how they fare, which always kind of turns into some kind of an allegory along the lines of Lord of the Flies. And this doesn't want to do that. It wants to make sure that we're not sort of making some grand statement about that we're using the children as pawns and as symbols. And I appreciated that. I think they really let the children shine.
Collisions, the film. Christy?
I really wanted to like this more than I did. I do not like it nearly as much as you did. I wish it were better because it is so timely and it is so sadly relevant. And not unlike Midnight Traveler, it takes what is seemingly a daunting topic and gets its arms around it in a very personal and intimate way. It is about just this one family, the giant topic of what is going on in our border right now. It depicts it through the prism of this one family's experience. I found it really clunky. The performances are all really stiff.
You didn't even like the girl?
I hate to be mean.
Okay. You know me. Leave it at that.
You know me. I hate being mean. But it's just, I wanted to like this more. It is. It's worth seeing in that it's so timely. But I just wish it were more. I don't know. For given what all happens here, it should be more emotionally gripping. It
is
felt a little restrained to me.
It's a bit of a road trip, and it has elements that are familiar. But I it's touching.
Collisions, the film. It's at Lemley's Music Hall in Beverly Hills. Unrated, written and directed by Richard Levine. Also want to mention that we lost Diane Carroll at the age of 84 on Friday morning. She was the first African-American woman to star as a professional in a network TV series. There had been Beulah with Ethel Waters, but in the case of Julia, she portrayed a widowed nurse raising a young boy, and she had a very long career. She was one of the stars of Dynasty, the network series, as well. But I also remember the performance that she gave in the film Claudine. She co-starred with James Earl Jones, a 1974 film. She was Oscar nominated for her performances. She starred as a single mother of six. She received public assistance to supplement her income and to support her family. Well, those welfare payments were the difference between keeping her apartment and being unable to provide for her kids. So as her love interest, the James Earl Jones character, when he visits her, he threatens her welfare benefits by being there because he's gainfully employed. In this scene, Diane Carroll as Claudine is confronted by her eldest son, and she has this response.
You're a damn crybaby.
I don't know why you killed me when I was born.
Oh, you talk crazier every day.
I mean, if you love me, you'd have killed me. Like the women back on those plantations. To kill the kids so wouldn't have to be slaves.
I guess I didn't love my children, right? Because I wanted them to live.
Yeah. So you told us to be afraid, right?
You better be afraid. You better be afraid. That world out there will kill you.
I mean, how can frightened people change anything?
They ain't no other kind of people, Charles. I'm scared all the time, but I do my job. If you ain't scared, you don't have no need for guts.
Diane Carroll and Claudine, I know this was a favorite of yours too, Wade.
I love Claudine. I think it's just a beautiful, beautiful movie that comes at a very difficult point in time in the 1970s when the sort of the racial politics of the 60s has bled into the 70s and the Watts riots and the Chicago riots and all these other things that are the assassinations, all these things that have sort of poisoned the culture in, along the lines of race relations. And Claudine is a movie that comes along. It's like it's therapeutic in a warm and wonderful and gentle way. Sounder was the other film from the period that did that. And her performance is just
so
beautiful. It's so poetic.
She's someone who's beautiful and could also, you know, deliver very strong dramatic lines. And
to hold her own against James Earl Jones.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, not many people can do that.
Who's the powerhouse in this film, Christy?
I think it's also a big deal. I know Dynasty sounds really cheesy and soapy, but the idea of her striding into a room and confronting Joan Collins and engaging her verbally, physically, it's a bold, daring moment there that we really hadn't seen on television very much from a black actress like that.
So Diane Carroll passing away Friday morning at the age of 84 at her home in Los Angeles. Again, Oscar nominated. She was a Tony Award winner for the musical No Strings and again made history with that 3-season-long NBC series Julia in which she played a nurse raising her young son. We also want to talk about Joker, which, of course, opens this week. Very controversial film, and momentarily we'll hear what our critics have to say about it.
One small thing. When you bring me out, can you introduce me as Joker?
So is that creepy enough for you?
There's that score I was talking about.
I love that score.
And the question we were asking as you reviewed the film, and in case you just joined us, Wade absolutely loved the film, is still thinking about it, found it so provocative. Christy, quite the opposite. But Christy, before we break, just real quickly, what concerned you morally about the film?
So it depicts him as being mentally ill. And it suggests that being mentally ill means you're also going to be violent, and not just violent, but homicidal on a massive scale. And that seems really icky and kind of gross to me. But at the same time, they also want to glorify him and celebrate him. One of the key images toward the end is of him on top of a cab. People are cheering for him and lights are exploding and he's like a rock star on stage. So it's problematic.
We'll hear what Wade has to say about it as well. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Back in 1 minute. Good to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Joker out this week, and there have been critics of the release of the film who felt like its depiction of violence and its association the audience has with the protagonist could potentially lead people to commit acts of violence. Similarly, there have been reports of security at some theaters that have been enhanced as a result of some of these fears. So, Wade, we just heard Christy say that the way mental illness is portrayed here with the character and kind of inevitability around that violence would result from that is disturbing.
Yeah, I mean, I never project those things into anything more global. This is this character in this particular instance, and we know that certainly there are mentally ill people who are not violent, and there are mentally ill people who are, just as there are mentally well people who are violent and mentally well people who aren't. So what I think people are projecting on the film incorrectly, and it's not that violent of a movie. If you look at the actual violence in it, John Wick movie has more violence in 5 minutes than this has in 122.
That's a very different context, though.
But see,
isn't
that's
it?
The thing too. Context is everything, and even something like Clockwork Orange, which was controversial at the time because of those murders in England, and it was pulled from distribution. And people, I think, want to believe that we can control things more than we can. And it is our natural inclination, whatever your politics, it is your natural inclination to say, this is the cause, we can attack that and we can fix the problem, whether it's, you know, it's guns, it's movies, it's drugs, it's mental health, it's family upbringings. They target these things.
I don't think that the critics are saying this would stop all violence
and this all goes to the Chicago or the Colorado theater shooting during the Dark Knight Returns. If that had never happened,
Dark Knight Rises.
Yes. Thank you. If that had never happened, we wouldn't be associating Joker as some kind of trigger element in the society. We wouldn't even be thinking about that. This would just be another Batman universe, DC universe Joker movie. But because of that, we now think, oh no, there was one guy that got set off by the last Joker, you know.
And that, in fact, was disproven. It wasn't actually the character.
Of course it was.
That set him off.
And I'm not suggesting in any way that this film is going to cause violence or even deserves the heightened level of security that we have seen at some theaters. I think that's crazy. You can't blame movies. You can't blame art for people's actions. That's not what I'm suggesting. I don't think Todd Phillips has any kind of responsibility for people's, you know, decisions or their impulses or whatever. I just don't think it's a very good movie.
Todd Phillips, of course, done comedies before this. He gave an interview to Vanity Fair where he said that essentially the censorship or efforts to control people's speech around woke culture, that essentially killed comedy. And that's why he's not doing it anymore. But, I mean, Wade, could you make the argument that sort of the same cultural reflex is trying to control this?
Perhaps. I don't think woke culture killed comedy. I think it changed the available audience for certain comics. Dave Chappelle is doing very, very well poking at woke culture on Netflix. The audience response to that has been outrageous. So there's an opportunity there. So Todd could certainly go out and tell as many jokes as he wants and make as many funny movies as he wants. Will he have the same audience or as broad an audience in as many of the same locations as he had before? I don't know. Maybe he has a better sense of that. But I think what's clear is it's on his mind. and it's bothering him, and this movie is a response to that. And society does go through these phases where it gets a little bit neurotically afraid of complete and uninhibited free speech. And as an absolutist when it comes to free speech, I think that's when the people who push back need to do things like this movie and remind us that these things don't make us do bad things.
And just clarify, Christy, you're not making the argument the film shouldn't have been made or shouldn't be released.
No, not at all. Yeah. And I think the whole thing with Todd Phillips blaming quote-unquote woke culture is a total cop-out. So many movies exist that are still the kind of raunchy R-rated comedy that he made his name on. Look at Dolomite. This week alone, we have an incredibly raunchy and profane and sexual and totally inappropriate comedy that is hilarious and a huge crowd pleaser. Look at Booksmart. Look at Good Boys. Look at Superbad. These movies can exist if they're written well, if they're smart. So to say, oh, I can't make a movie like Old School anymore, of course you can. Just do it well.
All right. We're talking with critics Christy Lemire, Wade Major. We're talking about the release of Joker. Wade, the film had, I think, record-breaking first night.
13.3 million, I think, in Thursday night previews, which is huge.
Into the weekend.
Yeah.
Expecting
it's
going to be a huge...
It's a big hit.
A huge weekend. But one thing as I was reading is that some critics who've had negative things to say about it, that there have been people who've piled on and threatened critics and things like that. Have you experienced this, Christy?
No, not with this. But I mean, I got death threats when The Dark Knight Rises came out because I was one of the first negative reviews, and I happened to be a woman. I'm the reason that there are no longer individual reader comments on Rotten Tomatoes reviews.
Really?
Because you were so abused on
because,
Rotten Tomatoes?
Well, I wasn't even the first negative review, so I was not the one to ruin the 100% that it had on the Tuesday before it opened. But I'm a woman. And that is a whole other level of online vitriol that's a delight to experience. People do get these kinds of awful feedback on Twitter. And it's about what? Like, we're not validating what they expect the movie experience is going to be. Go see the movie. Go see it for yourself. Have fun. Who cares what I think?
So these would have been people, presumably, who hadn't even seen the film.
Exactly.
Because your review would have just come out.
Exactly.
So there's like an affiliation with the franchise or the character that they're protecting.
They want proactive validation.
Don't you love social media?
Wow. No, I mean, there was a year where I did three really negative reviews in a row for The Incredible Hulk, Wanted, and Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. And apparently there was a hit put out on me at Comic-Con because the comments on those reviews I was this close to calling the FBI.
Was someone going to slice you in half with their lightsaber?
it was pretty ruthless.
Yes.
Well, if it hasn't given you pause, have some of your colleagues expressed concern over personal safety?
No, everybody always just says don't read the comments.
Good advice in general.
Yeah.
Yeah. So is that, you follow that too?
Yeah. You can't take it seriously. You can't respond. You can't feed the trolls. You cannot take it seriously. Just move on with your day.
Now back to Joker. Does this film in any way sort of change the universe of Batman because of how the character evolves?
No. I think we've changed the universe of Batman so many times. It's now fashion to see how many different ways it can be reinterpreted and how many different directors can sort of put their imprimatur on it. So I think this is a one-off. This is Todd Phillips taking his shot at it, and the next director will take his or her shot at it.
And there are still sort of key Batman lore moments that exist here.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it's not entirely a
it's
standalone
not, that's
thing.
That's true. It's not pure Joker.
All right. Thank you both so much, Christy Lemire, Wade Major, with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle, inviting you to join us for our next Film Week screening at the historic Theater at Ace Hotel. 1927 Vintage Theater began life as the United Artists flagship, and we're going to show Blade Runner Final Cut, the cut that Ridley Scott himself oversaw on the big screen of the Ace. We hope you'll join us Saturday night, November 2nd, 7 o'clock after the film, a post-screening conversation, and you can get your tickets by visiting our KPCC /in-person page and pick up your tickets there. Hope to see you Saturday night, November 2nd, Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown Los Angeles. From all of us at Film Week, have a terrific weekend.